Wee sleekit curin timorous beastie, oh what a panic's in thy breastie, thou need nae start away so hasty with bickering brattle, I would be late to run and chase ye with murdering pattle. Well, that's fantastic. I'm happy to welcome you to the 101st episode of the Religious Studies Project with myself, Dr. David Robertson, Christopher Cotter over here, and who's this? Great Chief Know the Puddin' Race over here.
Liam Sutherland.
Fantastic. Great to have you here, Liam.
We're still in Edinburgh University's TV union. I think we're all drinking pints of the heavy nettle.
I'm drinking Arran ale. It's got something. Okay. It's got Rabbi Burns on the front. It's called Gid Ale, I think.
Okay, it was quite. My sort of spontaneous Burns outburst there was not related to that or to Liam's presence or anything. It just kind of happened.
Nonetheless.
Beautifully said. Thank you. Brought to you in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and today's interview was conducted.
Do you know what that stands for? The BASR, the best association for the study of religions, because they really are.
They really are. Today's interview was conducted by Tommy Coleman. It's with Dimitris Zagalitas on a firewalking ritual. I'm actually really keen to hear about this. We haven't featured anything, but it's quite a sort of orientalized image I have of firewalking rituals, so I'm interested to hear a proper scholarly take on it rather than my sort of naive orientalism. Would be good. Take it away, Tommy.
Well, yeah, let's hear.
I'm with Dr. Dimitris Zagalitas. We're here on the Religious Studies Project today, and I promise Dimitris that I will not mispronounce his name throughout the entirety of this podcast, so I will just be calling Dr. Zagalitas Dimitris. So, Dimitris is the director for the Levania Laboratory for Experimental Research on Religion. He's associate professor in the Department for the Study of Religion at Masaryk University, assistant professor at the Interacting Minds Center in the Department of Culture and Society at Aarhus University, and the managing editor for the Journal for the Cognitive Science of Religion. Dimitris, thank you very much for joining us today on the Religious Studies Project.
Hi, Thomas. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to invite you to give us a brief overview of your research and academic interests before we jump into talking about the Aniston area of northern Greece.
Sure. Well, my research has always revolved around one big question. And that question is that in a lot of the world's cultures, past and present, we see some rituals that really push the envelope in terms of intensity. So they're either painful or harmful or dangerous or look really appalling to the outsiders. So my big question is, why do people engage in these behaviors? Evolutionary theory would have it that unless these behaviors have some benefits, either for the individual or for society in general, then they would be wiped out in the course of our evolutionary trajectory. And social anthropologists for many years now have come up with various answers to that question. And the most common answer is that these rituals convey certain benefits. They bring people together, they create social cohesion. And what I've been trying to do is how to study some of the most extreme or intense rituals performed around the world and to find ways to answer this question and also find ways to measure these effects.
Your interest with extreme rituals, how does that fit into the Aniston area of northern Greece?
All right, well, the Aniston area is one example of such really intense or high arousal, if you will, extreme rituals. The Aniston area is a tradition of northern Greece and southeast Bulgaria. It's a tradition that is mostly known for its firewalking rituals. It's a ritual that is quite old. We don't know exactly how old. There's various theories that connect it to antiquity, but there's no real evidence to support it. The fact of the matter is that it's at least a few centuries old, as far as we know, and potentially much older. And it's performed by people who are regular members of the Orthodox Christian Church in Greece, but in addition to all the church rituals, they have their own ritual cycle, which revolves around two focal saints. And these saints are Constantine and Helen. And in honor of those two saints, on May 21st every year, they perform firewalking rituals.
What is some of the overall context and cultural setting in which the Anastinaria operate in? As I understand, there's a lot of tension between the local community, the Greek Orthodox Church. They've even stolen some of their items and locked them in a church.
Yes. The Anastinaria come from originally from Eastern Thrace, which is an area which today belongs to Bulgaria. There were mixed populations there during the time of the Ottoman Empire, so Turkish, Greek, and Bulgarian, as it was the case throughout the empire. And after the first Balkan War, there was a rearrangement of the borders, and eventually, with the Treaty of Lausanne, there was a redistribution of populations. So then the Greek-speaking people of that area were forced to flee their homes and come to what today is Greece, and vice versa. So these rituals are performed in a small village called Kosti. And when these people were forced to flee and to move to what is today the Greek part of Macedonia, they brought their icons and their rituals with them. And they were primarily installed in five small villages of northern Greece, where they perform these rituals to this day. And that happened almost a century ago. Now, these rituals, especially after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the creation of the first Greek state, these rituals were used by Greek historiographers and early ethnographers as a case study, as a political tool to assert the continuity of Greek civilization. The truth is, with zero evidence, and it wasn't the only case, but it's one of the most pronounced cases.
I was going to say, certainly this isn't the first time that ethnographies and scientific research has taken on a very political dimension.
No, absolutely. And that was actually the more general character of Greek folklore studies, which were modeled after the folk studies in Germany and the movement of Romanticism, which sought to create a national identity by establishing superficial connections between antiquity and modern times, and then claiming that this was proof of continuity. In the case of the Anastinaria, that caused a lot of problems to the people themselves, because based on a report written by a 19th century theologian, these were ancient relics of Dionysian orgiastic cults. And what happened in Dionysian orgiastic cults was, well, obviously orgies, but also devouring of raw animals, of live animals. The Anastinaria did neither one, but nonetheless.
I was going to ask you if you had observed any of this alleged behavior.
No, absolutely not. That's pure imagination. And it was, you know, the way ethnography functioned at those times was that there was a scholar who would never visit the place because they would consider these people to be savages, so no reason to mingle with them. So they would send some of their assistants, which were typically priests, to witness the ritual for a couple of hours, then go back and write a report. And that's what happened with these reports, obtained from two priests and written up by a theologian called Hurmuziadis, who had never witnessed the ritual himself. So he wrote that these are Dionysian orgiastic relics, and that they're connected to drunkenness and orgies and this and that. And you can imagine that the church, which was very powerful at the time, didn't like that. Mm-hmm. And even today, the Greek church opposes this ritual. Today it's only in the form of rhetoric, but as recently as 30 years ago, the church would actively obstruct the performance of the Anastenaria. They would send the police. They would confiscate their icons. So at some point, their icons were stolen by the local bishop, and the people had to go to court, and they won them back eventually. And that created a lot of tension between this community and the formal, the official church. Well, if you ask the people themselves, they would say that they're very devout Christians, which is something to which I can attest, and that they get very upset and very offended when people question their faith.
You had mentioned these icons. What do these icons consist of? What do they mean to the Anastenaria?
The icons are very fundamental to the performance of the Anastenaria. So they depict various saints, and the most important ones depict the saints Constantine and Helen themselves. And they're believed to have special powers. They're able to heal people. They bring good luck. And when the first firewalker goes onto the glowing coals, he carries the icon. And then the firewalkers take turns in carrying the icon across the fire. They believe that without the icons, they wouldn't have the power to walk across the coals unharmed. And indeed, when their icons were stolen by the church, there was one year which was the only year where the firework was not performed.
As I understand, these icons also interact with the people. They call out to them, they speak to them, and there was actually an instance of them calling out from inside the locked church.
Yes, and some of these icons are actually the original icons that were brought from Eastern Thrace over 100 years ago. And there's several myths and legends about these icons. One of the most widespread ones is that as the church in Kosti caught fire one day, the icons were called out to the people to come and save them. And somebody walked in through the fire and removed the icons and emerged unharmed by the fire. And that's how the firewalking ritual started. That is the legend, the most popular one.
Now, is there any sort of written text, any sort of oral tradition that is passed down whereby they have perhaps a central dogma or tenets? How is knowledge transmitted in the Anastenaria, or is it?
There's no written text. There's no formal doctrine specific to the Anastenaria. Obviously, people subscribe to the doctrines of the Orthodox Church, but there's no doctrine whatsoever specific to the Anastenaria. So religious knowledge and ritual knowledge is passed down by practice and example from one generation to the next. And in fact, there's very little explicit teaching, or none almost, and very little discussion even of the meaning of the ritual or anything that would resemble a doctrine. So people, the ritual gets perpetuated through personal participation and experience.
As I understand, even the elders in the village aren't so keen to transmit what they know and talk to some of the younger members in the village. And you even, I believe, got a request to replicate CDs of your interview with one of the elder Anastenaria to distribute to some of the younger.
That is true. And people don't really talk about the ritual much. There is a general perception that the elders have a vast amount of knowledge and wisdom. However, the elders would typically say that they don't know much. The saints know things, and they're just the saints' instruments. So they're not very willing to discuss things, even factual things in terms of their own personal history and participation in the ritual. So yeah, it's true. One day I sat with a couple of elders and I recorded a conversation about the ritual with a lot of anecdotes and a lot of personal experience. And towards the end of the interview, the son of one of the elders came in and he heard the last part of our talk. And afterwards he asked me to give him a copy of the CD because he said we rarely have the chance to hear about these things ourselves.
What are some of the myths that you heard, some of the stories that some of the elder Anastenaria have told you over that have happened throughout the centuries?
the icons again play a central role in most of the stories. So some of the commonly of the recurrent themes have to do with icons calling out or appearing in people's dreams, or the saints depicted in the icons, and revealing the location of some buried or hidden icon. And then people will start digging and find the icons. And similarly, each one of these villages has its sacred well, where they draw sacred water from. And these wells have been dug up in locations that have been revealed to people's dreams. So dreams are fundamental in this tradition. They constitute what people call signs. And a sign can be basically any kind of random event or seemingly random event can have a special meaning. I remember one day I was sitting with this woman who was narrating one dream after the other and saying that this dream meant that, or I saw this saint appearing in my sleep and telling me that everything would be okay. And a week later, my daughter made the exam to go to university. And things, a variety of things. And at the end of this series of narrations, she told me about one dream. And at the end, she said, "I haven't found an explanation for this dream yet. But, that was 20 years ago. But I'm sure that one day something will happen to me in light of which this dream will make sense."
In terms of the rituals, the fire walking rituals that they actually perform, how often do they happen? And I was also wondering if you could really walk us through kind of the affair, what it's like building up to these to the rituals during and after.
So this ritual is part of an entire annual ritual cycle, which involves a variety of ritual actions, most of which are very low arousal and extremely repetitive. So throughout the year, the Anastenaria will meet in various occasions on specific dates, and they will first perform cleansing rituals, or literally clean the konaki, which is the room where the ritual is performed. The ritual is part of a festival. It's actually performed twice a year. There's a winter ritual in the festival of Saint Athanasius, and there's that's in January, and there's one in May, which is the major one, and it's the day of the two patron saints, Constantine and Helen. And this festival lasts for 3 days. And during these days, every day you have a number of processions around the village. People will gather at the konaki. They will sing together. The music starts playing, they will start dancing.
If I could interrupt you real fast, yes. could you go over the konaki for us? What is the konaki?
The konaki is simply a room.
Okay.
It's a Turkish word to describe a room or a hall. And in the context of the Anastenaria, it's the word used to describe the room where the dance before the firework takes place. The firework at some point used to be held indoor, and even to this day, the winter firework takes place inside the konaki. There's a fireplace there, and they spread the coals in front of the fireplace and walk through them. In May, there's the fireworking ritual takes place in front of the konaki. There's a specially designated area which is used only for this purpose once a year. But inside the konaki, you have people dancing. There's loud music coming from drums and the lyre. There are songs about the lost homelands. These songs evoke a lot of collective memories, although nobody in today's generations has been born in those lost homelands. But these are collective memories that play a crucial role in people's collective identity. And you can see that when the music starts playing, people's faces change. They become pensive and serious, and some of them start crying. And then what they call it, they say that they're being moved by the saint. Mm-hmm. Little by little, you see people start moving and shaking and eventually engaging into this trance state and dancing around for several hours. And this happens every day for the duration of the festival, for 3 days. Mm-hmm. There is also an animal sacrifice. A black male sheep is sacrificed, along with a number of other sheep, which are offerings from the people. And on the day of the firework, which is the third day of the festival, people build up a lot of tension. They dance for several hours in that state that I described, which appears to be a trance-like state. Imagine a room which is fairly small, like a typical, let's say, the size of an average university classroom, filled with 200-300 people.
Wow.
Most of them just watching, but then a number of people performing, dancing in a very secluded space, so their movements are very restricted. There's very loud, repetitive music, which you can really feel deep down in your stomach. You feel the vibrations. And the music is very imposing. It really drives the dance. You have smells coming from incense burning. There's a lot of sensory stimulation. And it's very, very hot at that time of the year. People dance like this for several hours, so they really get into a special mode of consciousness. And then it's time to go out during the night and walk across a bed of burning, glowing coals that has been prepared. And that's the culmination of the ritual. They call it dancing across the coals. Mm-hmm. It's more of a walk. They carry the icons of the saints, without which they think it would be impossible to perform this. And they will cross the fire several times, one after the other, until it's completely put out by their bare feet.
And we have an excellent description now of really what's going on, what the culture is like, what the ritual cycle is like, you know, kind of the pageantry, what's going on when they're participating in these rituals. I was hoping you might be able to bring in some possible psychological, cognitive underlying processes that may be maybe encouraging this.
Right. There's several levels at which these effects might be manifest. Some of the levels I described in my book have to do, for example, with individual psychological effects. One very well-known process in the psychological literature on ritual is what we call cognitive dissonance. That means that for whatever reason, people get drawn into these rituals, but once they have performed them, then subconsciously, your mind is thinking, why have I done this extremely demanding ritual? This must be very important. So through their own participation, people come to attribute tremendous significance to those rituals. That's something we know very well from psychology. In experiments that were conducted as early as the 60s and have been continued to show consistent results, we see that people who have been asked to go through a painful initiation to join a group, they come to value the group more, they come to value the experience more. So this is just one level of the several that this could be happening.
Certainly, any students listening who may have joined a fraternity are probably no stranger
absolutely.
To such.
Absolutely, and we know these effects have influenced the way rituals have been selected, culturally selected throughout the ages, and that's an unconscious process. But at the same time, we consciously know about these effects, and we use them in hazing rituals, we use them in military rituals, in initiations. If you ask somebody. If you tell somebody you want to create a group and you want a cohesive group and you want an initiation process, everybody will come up instinctively with some very high arousal or painful experience. So these are some mechanisms that we know very well. One thing that I noticed was that both in among my participants, but especially looking at the literature way back, was that there seemed to be... This is viewed as a healing ritual by many people, not by everybody. There's no consensus as to why it's performed, but some people see it as a healing ritual. And there were some recurrent themes in the kinds of conditions people wanted to be healed from. And the most common ones were certain mental illnesses, and especially things like depression. Now, these rituals seem to be perfect candidates for altering brain chemistry in certain ways that might be helpful towards dealing with depression. We know from recent studies that intense physical exercise might be just as effective as antidepressants for fighting depression. So by engaging in really intense physical movement, you might be triggering endocrine responses, for example, dopamine release. And this is directly related to these conditions. Also, socialization, obviously, is a very important thing. If you're, I remember a story narrated to me by this old woman who said she claimed that she had been healed by depression by performing the ritual. So she was suffering. She said, "I was staring at my window for 2 years. I didn't go out of my home for 2 years. And then they brought in the anastenaria, and they told me I should firewalk, and I would get saved." Now, you have various things happening here. One, of course, is hope, right? Mm-hmm. So there's always a placebo effect in any treatment, including the ones that work at a physiological level.
Which is no less real, correct?
You know, absolutely, it's no less real. The second thing is that this woman hadn't left her home for 2 years. Now, for the first time, she left her home. She socialized, she saw people, she hang out with them. Perhaps afterwards, after the end of the ritual, I'm not claiming that performing the ritual would be enough to cure you from depression, but perhaps after these 3 days, she would be less shy of meeting people again. Perhaps she had a couple of visitors over and she started mingling with the group again. And then, of course, you have physiological levels of whether you see it as pure exercise, the level of physiological stimulation that is involved, which is very, very crucial in people suffering from depression, or other kinds of responses. I think they all might contribute to certain kinds of conditions, just like this one. And there's a significant amount of people who suffered from depression who engaged in this ritual.
You had also mentioned an interesting contrast between monotonous, low arousal church services widely, every Sunday in the Greek Orthodox Church, and then these, very intense, but seldomly, they're only, I guess, firewalkers only participated in twice a year. How does this explain ritual? Why do we see kind of two extremes, one being very low arousal and the other just extremely?
Well, already in the early 90s, some cognitive theorists of religion, most prominently Harvey Whitehouse and Bob McCauley and Tom Lawson, described two attractor poles in the way ritual transmission works, and they noticed that the majority of rituals around the world, the vast majority, fall into one of two categories. They're either very highly arousing, they're either extreme rituals, very intense, performed very rarely, or they're very unarousing, mundane, boring rituals, if you will, which are performed very frequently. Now these, each mode seems to trigger a different kind of mechanism, a learning mechanism. One works by imprinting of very powerful stimuli, very emotional stimuli. It creates powerful memories of them. The other one works through repetition, through semantic memory. In the case of the anastenaria, we have a system which is part of a very doctrinal mode, in the words of Whitehouse, which means that you have very routinized, repetitive, tedious rituals. If there's any religion that doesn't have high arousal or exciting rituals, that's Orthodox Christianity. There's nothing high arousal there. And then you have the anastenaria, which for one day every year break this cycle by performing the most emotionally arousing ritual in Greece. And I think that the combination of these two, so the anastenaria themselves frequently told me that firewalking is just the icing on the cake, or it's just one element, and it's the whole ritual cycle that matters. It's just as important. But I do have the feeling that if it wasn't for the firewalk, then perhaps the tradition wouldn't have survived. I think that these highly arousing rituals create long-lasting memories, whether they're accurate or not, it doesn't make any difference. They trigger what White House calls spontaneous exegetical reflection. That means that people spend a lot of time thinking about the ritual and coming up from justifications for their own performance. They lead to collective memories of shared arousal, and that's very important. And just like it happens with military rituals or fraternity rituals, these are experiences that nobody else understands. These people have something in common. They share an experience that nobody else can understand. So they immediately know that they're part of the same group, and they're the only ones who have this knowledge through personal experience.
You talked about the spontaneous exegetical reflection, and what I found very interesting was that the younger members of the Anastinaria, usually less than 3 years of experience firewalking, don't necessarily have the reasons and the meaning that the older generation does, the more experienced. Now, you know, this is to be expected, or is this unique? What?
That is correct, and it's not unique. I've been studying these high arousal rituals in Greece and Bulgaria and in Spain and Mauritius, and I see the same pattern everywhere. In my view, the vast majority of people perform a ritual for the first time just because either their parents brought them to it or because other people do it. And most of the time, they can't even explain why they do it. They just the most common answer that anthropologists hear is we do it because everybody does it, because that's our tradition, because we've always done it this way, and so on and so forth. But once you have performed such a powerful, emotional, and intense experience, then you come to develop not just a justification for having performed it, but a whole life view based on this experience. So it's very common to see that as they continue participating in these rituals, their sense of meaning for these rituals and purpose for these rituals develops much more. So in my fieldwork on the Anastinaria, I was asking everybody the same question: why is the ritual performed? Why do you do it? Why did you do it the first time? I saw there was a sharp contrast between first-timers or those who weren't very experienced and those who had done it many, many times. The former would say, I don't really know. We just do it because everybody else does it. Or some people even told me very honestly that I was just sitting there and I felt this urge. Mm. And it's easy to imagine that, especially if you're susceptible to certain things like the effects of music. Even for me, it was really a powerful experience to be in that small room with such strong repetitive music. It really puts you into a certain mode.
Music makes people want to dance. You hear it and get up.
So they would say, I just felt this urge to do it, and I joined the group. And there's this saying in Greek that goes, if you join the dance, then you have to dance. So I just did it. Somebody even told me, well, I was swinging with the music and somebody pushed me, so suddenly I was in the dance, and then I had to go through the whole thing, 3 days of dancing and then eventually firewalking. And now I can't stop. And now I have to do it every time. They have this sense of urgency. Now, when I went to the elders, it was a different story. Most of them had an idea of why they did it for the first time. Some were, and it wasn't the same for everybody. There was no consensus. There was no doctrine. It was idiosyncratic. Healing was a theme. Fertility was another theme, either for the crops to grow or for somebody to be able to conceive a child. All sorts of promises to the saint or giving thanks for some good fortune. All sorts of explanations. Now, in my case, I was lucky enough that previous generations of anthropologists that have studied this ritual either used real names in their writings, a practice which is no longer done by anthropologists. We now use pseudonyms to protect anonymity. Or the village is so small that you can recognize everybody through their life stories. So in several cases, I would read people's accounts of why they did it 30 years ago, and they would say, I don't know, I just felt this urge to do it, or I'm not really sure. Everybody does it, so I thought I would try it, and now I can't stop doing it, and so on and so forth. And then 30 years later, when I asked them, they said, they gave me a very precise answer. They said, I did it to get healed, or I did it to save somebody who was suffering, or I did it for this or that reason. So they came to develop a meaning and a purpose for the ritual through their own participation.
Wanted to jump tracks here for a moment and perhaps head off on a personal note. And yourself is a researcher living and experiencing daily life with the Anniston area. What was one of the most rewarding experiences or a specific instance that you've reflected upon over the years that's taken on a specific meaning and significance for you?
Well, the most rewarding experience for any anthropologist is to realize that towards the end of your fieldwork, you've managed to establish personal relationships with your subjects and to be trusted by them, and to be, and especially in the case of the Anastenaria, where they had specific historical reasons, which we have discussed, to be suspicious of anthropologists. That was very meaningful to me. So when I first went there, people were not willing to talk about their religion. And it's not that they were closed. They were very open and very friendly people. They would invite me to their home. As soon as I knocked on their door, they would say, sit here, you're going to have lunch with us or coffee. And I had to have multiple lunches and coffees every day. But when the conversation came on ritual or religion, they would say, we don't want to talk about that. But they would discuss much more sensitive issues before that. They would discuss disease, for example, before they were willing to discuss religion, because they had their own reasons, which are perfectly understandable after what they've been through because of bad anthropologists. Anthropologists who did bad work. This went on for a few months. I actually considered changing my field site, hoping that I might be able to find people who are more willing to talk. Eventually, I decided to stay and take my chances and lay low and just hoping that people would open up. And that's what eventually happened. After a few months, people started talking to me about the ritual, about pretty much everything. And towards the end of my stay, I had made good friends and I had gotten very good accounts that, as we mentioned, even some of the insiders weren't able to get.
Is there anything else that you might like to relay to the public and our listeners on the Religious Studies project about the Anniston area or about firewalking rituals that you feel we haven't touched upon?
I mean, there's one anecdote that I might want to mention here, which is that I did do the firewalk myself, but it wasn't among the Anniston area.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And please tell.
It is an interesting story. So a lot of the time, when I give lectures about firewalking, typically the first question I get from the audience is, have you done it? And for many years, my answer was, no, I haven't done it. And for very good reasons, because I studied firewalking in Greece and then in Spain and currently in Mauritius. In the case of Greece and Spain, these are very closed communities, and firewalking has a special meaning. First of all, in Spain, it's out of the question because it's only reserved for locals. Outsiders are not supposed to perform it. It would be insulting if I wanted to do it. In the case of the Anastenaria, you have to be a member of the, you have to be a believer, and you have to be gradually accepted by the elders. And once you do it, then it's an obligation you undertake for life. So there would be, even if I wanted to become part of the group and perform the firewalking ritual, I would be expected to go back and do it every year. And I had no interest in in doing it just by pretending to to be committed to this. I never thought that I should be dishonest with these people and then do it. I knew they would be very disappointed if I didn't go back and do it, and I would be seen as somebody who just took advantage of them, and that's, I would never want to do that. Now, when I went to Mauritius, the situation was radically different. Then, after the first few months of being in the community, one of the temple officials brought it up, and he said something like, well, now you're one of us, and you should actually also do the firewalk with us. And I politely refused, and I said, look, my job as an ethnographer is different, and I'm here to observe, and I'm here to learn from you, and I learn about your tradition, and I want to take my pictures. And he said, okay, if God wants you to do it, then you will do it. And I remember saying, trust me, Prakas, God doesn't want me to do it. Well, apparently I was wrong. So when the day came, I had permission to be inside the special enclosure reserved for the fireworkers only to take pictures. And the President Temple waved at me and he said, come here, you'll get better pictures from this spot. And I did. And it was indeed a good spot for pictures. And a while later, he said, come here again. And I said, what? And then he turned me around and I was suddenly facing 500 people expecting me to firewalk. And I remember exactly what he told me.
You must perform.
He said, now you will know what the fire is like. Oh. And the only thing I had time to say was, please hold my camera. So I went ahead and did it. And 500 people saw me do it. So if I said no at that point, it would be both personal humiliation, but also importantly, it would cause a disruption to the ritual itself. And it would be offensive to the people. So I went ahead and did it. And one of the most interesting things about it is that some of my participants were asking me ethnographic questions afterwards. Things like, well, what made you do it? And, how did it make you feel? And,
the researcher becomes researched.
Yes.
Wow. Well, I'm certainly glad that we had space to ask that last question, because that was the most interesting story I have heard yet, and I'm a little bit jealous of sorts. So, I don't believe we've mentioned your book specifically during this podcast, and I want to go ahead and point out for any of the listeners out there, if you're interested in Demetrius's work on the Anastinarian firewalking rituals that they perform, check out The Burning Saints, Cognition and Culture in the Firewalking Rituals of the Anastinaria. Demetrius, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the Religious Studies Project today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation.
We should talk about having a series of Tommy speaks to dangerous rituals. I mean, that's kind of his bag, isn't it? He said we've had firewalking rituals, we've had snake handling. Is that it?
Have we had something more? There have been...
Russell McCutcheon.
Yeah, that was quite dangerous as well. Almost by the time this goes out... No, I don't think by the time this goes out, but I'm meeting Tommy in the flesh fairly soon, and it's going to be awesome. So there'll be a special podcast recorded.
Yeah, I'm going to step aside for that week and let Chris and Tommy present the Religious Studies Project. We're going to get a spittoon in especially, and you know, anything to make him feel at home, like large hats and some cattle. But anyway, that's this week's interview. What's happening next week, Chris?
Next week it's the return of the sort of long-awaited book reviews podcast. We did one of these back, I think it was in November of 2012, the last time we published one.
Yeah.
And, you know, it worked quite well. And it took us a while to get around to doing some more, but we've got some good relationships with some publishers, and we appointed Jonathan to be Book Reviews editor, and this is Jonathan's
first fruits. Wouldn't it be great if we had somebody here who could tell us a little bit more about next week's episode?
Liam?
Well, next week you'll be listening to Jonathan's able cheering of myself, Beth Singler and Chris Duncan as we discuss various books that we were assigned to read. I was looking at Graham Harvey's Food, Sex and Strangers.
And now that we need to make sure that you've been nice about Graham, given that, you know, the BASR are our sponsors.
The BASR are awesome, and that is an incredibly fun title for a book from our exceedingly wonderful and illustrious leader.
That's good.
Beth Singler was looking at, I can't remember the exact name of the book, but it was a series of philosophical essays on the New Age.
Philosophical approaches to the New Age. I think it's as simple as that, yeah. I think you're right.
You always seek for something complicated when it's pretty simple.
Yeah.
And finally, Chris Duncan was looking at our own Professor Cox's The Invention of God in Indigenous Societies. We recorded this in a tiny little room in New College.
And Beth was not there.
Beth was speaking to us by the magic of computer technology. We had tried to all do this separately via the magic of computer technology the day before, but this unfortunately did not work. But
due to the crushing reality of not having a microphone.
Not having a microphone or a camera or, in my case, any common sense whatsoever.
Yeah, great. So, I mean, it's great. Jonathan's a sure hand. Liam's a sure hand. Beth, we've had on before, and
Chris is, you know, he's Chris.
And Chris is great. It's good to finally get him on the show. But yeah, so I'm as we're recording this, I have not heard that. I'm very very keen to hear this.
But that's what happens when you sort of hand over the reins. We've been talking a lot about that recently.
Well, it's a bit like when you turn up at the school to pick your kids up, and you know they all run out and they went, "Oh, it's had a nice day," and you're like, "What does that mean? Was there bullying? What happened when you were there?" And the teacher's not giving you any information. That's how I feel about this. But
there may have been some bullying, but you know, Jonathan.
Knowing Jonathan, yes, there was bullying. But so yes, that's what we're going to have next week.
Yeah.
The first of hopefully many episodes. We're hoping to have one of those out every 3 or 4 months. In fact, we're more than hoping. We're bullying Jonathan into making sure that that happens.
Absolutely. So yeah, if you are involved in any book project, if you work for a publisher, we're here, and we're keen to review your books in our sort of more informal, jovial setting, but also we think that we provide a certain sort of edge that doesn't come, and also we've got a greater exposure perhaps than many journal book reviews would get.
I don't think you sold us very well there. I mean, I think, you know, the traditional journal model works very well for speaking to people in the specifics of your field, but here you've got a captive audience of every not every, but a large proportion of the postgraduate community of religious studies. Presenting a book in that way is a different audience, but I think it's a broader audience.
And presenting it in conversation allows already for that sort of outside audience to come in a bit more when you have three people talking about a book rather than just one, a person explaining it to two or three other people who have not heard it before and who then get to ask questions about it. It becomes much more dynamic.
That's all good. So we have Google Plus, we have Facebook, we have
Twitters,
we have Facebooks. Did I say that already?
iTunes.
We've got Facebooks, we've got iTunes, we've got Google Plus,
the
we've got Facebook, we've got your Twitters.
And the Amazons. There are actually plural Amazons, co.uk, com, and ca.
These are women who have cut off their breasts in order to support their religious studies project. That's an obscure reference, possibly offensive. Do you want to record this again? That was the Greek model of the Amazons cut off one of their breasts to fire the arrows.
Yeah. I think now that you've clarified it, it's no longer offensive.
We'll go back. We'll do it again.
No.
You've got your Google Plus, you've got your Twitter, you've got your Facebook, you've got your Amazons.
And the iTunes.
And the iTunes. That's everything, isn't it? The BASR Ace, we've mentioned that already.
And it's just up to Liam now to say
thanks for listening.